And I want to read to you five verses that are there. I showed up and forgot something really important. I forgot my belt. So I don't want anyone talking about all the pant hiking that I'm going to be doing tonight. It's be inevitable. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul says some of the most pointed statements, I think, that he says in all of his Gospels, and he directs them to us in regard to the subject of marriage. And so in the first part of that chapter, he speaks to singles, and then you can look back verses 1 through 11 of 1 Corinthians 7. He speaks to singles, and then he speaks to married people, and then he speaks to people who are separated but thinking about getting a divorce. But then in verse 12, he begins to talk to people who are married, but one's a Christian and one's not a Christian. He's talking about mixed marriages at that point. But I want to talk to you from this passage about the purpose of marriage. Last week we talked a bit about a definition and, you know, leaving, cleaving, committing. But I want to talk to you about marriage as a commitment that's a covenant intent on producing the highest spiritual good in our life. And so there'll be some overlap, but let me read to you what Paul says here, and then we'll sort of look at some of the pieces that he gives. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 12 says this, "But to the rest I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she's willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you shall save your husband? And how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife?" Now, when you think about marriage, there's a lot in the Bible about marriage, and the reason is because God invented marriage. You could say that the two great institutions that God invented and that you can have certainty that He'll help you with is the church and marriage. There's not a lot in the Bible, nothing that I know of, about running a nonprofit charity. There's nothing in there about running a school. There's some principles in regards to business, I suppose, that you could say, and you could take some of the principles that are there and apply it to other venues, but it doesn't seem as though God is as concerned about those things as He is, first of all, about the church, and secondly, about our marriages. And again, that's because He's the author of both, and He has vested interest in both. Now, this passage is one of several, and instead of trying to give you a survey of every other place in the Bible that says what this one says, I just want to dial down here and pick it apart for a bit, and again drive at the point here that the Bible is overwhelmingly opposed to divorce on the basis of what marriage is, which is a leaving, cleaving, committed relationship where two people enter into a covenant. Now, when you say it's a commitment with a covenant, let me break that apart. In verse 12, again, Paul will say here, if a brother or wife has, or if a brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. In other words, he's saying, do whatever you can to not divorce. I don't want you to divorce. Now, later on, he'll say, if they abandon you and say, I'm not going to live with you, I don't want to be married to a Christian, you're not a person that I have any affection for, I don't want you. Then he says, well, in that case, you're not bound, and you can let them go. Now, the kickback on that is you shouldn't be the one who drove them away. I remember the older preachers would say, you know, in the Old Testament, only a man could divorce his wife. Only the man could create a bill of divorcement. A wife could not legally instigate a divorce. But if a wife wants a divorce, she knew how to get one. I mean, it's like she didn't file the paperwork, but she made life so miserable that he filed the paperwork. And again, you know, there are people who say, well, you know, he divorced me, he left me. Well, you're not entirely guilt-free before the Lord if you made the situation so miserable that it was keep his sanity or leave. And you can do that to a man. A man can do that to a woman. And so he says here, and this is one of the two reasons or two biblical reasons for divorce. One is here the abandonment. The other is adultery that Jesus would talk about. Now, are there other grounds for divorce? You know, the Bible is silent on that issue. It's just silent. People say, well, what about physical violence? And I would say at the very least, you shouldn't be in a relationship where there's physical violence. Don't just call on God, call the cops. And, you know, I think at the very least you would have a separation. Again, God would have to speak to you in that situation. But I don't think it's right to say that you are bound to live in the house with a person that is unsafe to live with. Again, but the Bible just doesn't talk about that issue, and drawing conclusions on that issue, you know, we may have the privilege, we may not, and I think each case would be different in that regard. But again, the point here, verse 12 again, is live with them unless they refuse to live with you. Again, we're talking about a mixed marriage here, not an abusive relationship. And the reason is because marriage is, again, based on a commitment. It's based on a commitment. Marriage is not entirely based on feelings of love. Because feelings can come and go. And you understand that in 1 Corinthians 13, when love is described, it's always actions. It's never feelings. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love doesn't boast. Love is long-suffering. Love hopes all things, believes all. Love is doing more than feeling. Now, if you do it, that tends to create the feeling. And sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes feelings produce the doing, but doings more certain to produce the feelings. But again, love is action. And a lot of times people would say, well, I don't feel this way. Or, well, again, a long-term relationship is based on the level of commitment, not the feelings in the moment. And so when we talk about feelings, feeling like you like or love a person, again, is not the basis for that relationship. See, when people make wedding vows, and when I do weddings, I guess if the vows are okay, if people write their own vows and they're legitimate vows, I'm okay with that. But I usually like to do, you know, better or worse, sickness, health, richer for poor, till death do us part. I like to do the I do's and the vows, because a lot of people who write their own vows, it's not really vows. It's expression of feeling. A vow is my commitment to you to be at a certain place in a certain time, regardless of what happens between here and there. So when I make my vow to you, let's say it's a 20-year vow. I say, I'm committed to you for 20 years. What that means is that I don't know what's going to happen in the next 20 years. I don't know who the presidents are going to be. I don't know how much I'll weigh or how much you weigh. I don't know. I don't know if I'll have any hair left or if you'll have any hair left. I don't know. I don't know. I know a lot's going to be different between here and there. 20 years is a long time. Lots of things are going to change. I don't know where we'll be living. I don't know. I don't know if all my body parts will be working. I don't know if I'll be able to hear what you have to say or be able to see. I don't know. All I know is that in 20 years, I'll be there. That's my commitment to you. I don't know what's in between. Now, when I make a lifetime commitment, again, marriage isn't a 20-year commitment. It's a lifetime commitment. So what I'm committing to you is that the day will come, if the Lord doesn't come, when one of us will send the other one off to heaven. That's my vow. Now, I don't know what's going to be between here and there. There's going to be a lot of stuff. We cannot anticipate what life will be like between here and the day that one of us says goodbye in the short run. I'll see you later. But my commitment is that regardless of what's in between, I'll be there. We have an appointment. We're going to keep that appointment together. Now, that's the essence of the commitment. And again, marriage in the one body analogy, that's the commitment. I mean, that's the commitment you have for your body. It's like, my commitment is that when I go to heaven, I want everything with me. I don't want to lose anything. This is it. I want to go with. I realize it's not going to look like this, but I'm going to keep it all. That's my big goal is when, you know, I'm laying on my deathbed, all of me is still there. That's my commitment to my body. And that's my commitment to my mate. And so because of that, I'm just hitting some things along the way here. Because of that, it would be hard to argue that you have a commitment of that magnitude apart from being married. I mean, people say, well, you know, we're not married, but we're committed to each other. See, but the question is if you're committed to each other, why wouldn't you get married? Why wouldn't you get married? And people, you know, I think the hard truth of the matter is this. The reason that you're not married is somebody doesn't love the other one enough to make the commitment. That's the bottom line. He or she isn't willing to say, I love you so much, I'll make an appointment with you on your deathbed. There's still a part of them that wants the out. I want some way to get out of this. Usually, the answer is if my needs aren't being met like I really want them to be met. See, again, I don't know. If you're in the box and Perry Mason is grilling you, I don't know how you're going to stand up to the questioning of why you've been dating her for 15 years, but you won't marry her. I don't know how you're going to defend yourself and say, no, I'm committed to her. Because, again, the bottom line becomes, if you're committed, why wouldn't you get married? And again, we have our reasons, but I think that would be a hard sell, and maybe there is an argument. I'm not saying there's not, because a lot of people make that argument. I'm just saying that would be a hard argument to make. Now, it's a commitment based on a covenant. That's what marriage is. Now, when we say better or worse, richer for poor, sickness and in health, we're just not making a commitment. But again, we're making a covenant commitment with each other. And a covenant commitment is the opposite of a consumeristic commitment. And again, there are a lot of people who would say at some level, I mean, you can get married and say, well, we made a commitment, but it's not going to last unless it's a covenant commitment. I mean, again, that's what you generally have with your children. You generally have a covenant commitment. I mean, if you didn't have a covenant commitment with your kids, you'd already killed them. Because if it was a consumeristic commitment with your kids, you don't get enough from your kids to hold the commitment. I mean, financially, they're a disaster. Worst investment you'll ever make is a kid. I mean, I hear if you got a really good kid by the time you're 18 or 20, they'll tell you, attaboy, dad. But you're not going to hear it before 18 or 20, even with a good kid. I mean, they don't seem to comprehend the price that you pay and what you give to them until a much later date, maybe even up to the point that they start having their own kids. That's a long time to go unappreciated. I mean, again, marriage isn't the big transition. It's having kids. I mean, listen, as long as you guys, you know, are minimally sane and you get married, that's not that big of a transition. All you are roommates. I mean, she can do her thing. You can do your thing. You come home. It's the kids that create this issue where now everything has to be scheduled. Where are you going to be? Well, somebody's got to pick them up at 4 o'clock. Well, are you going to be there because somebody's got to get them at 7 o'clock? Well, no, we can't travel at night because we can't travel. Everything has to be thought about. It's the kids that change your life. Marriage is, you know, just one step beyond shacking up, really. Put it that way. But it's the kids that make the difference. And they don't know that. But you have a covenant commitment with them. I am covenanting with them. I don't look at them from a consumeristic point of view. Because if I was looking at my kids saying, what have they done for me lately? They'd be gone. So the commitment is covenantal. See, a consumeristic relationship is my relationship with Food City. I like them, but if the prices go up, they can get dumped. It's the relationship you have. I mean, why did all the mom and pop stores go out of business? Because we didn't have covenant relationships with mom and pop. We liked mom and pop. They were great. But when they couldn't match Walmart's pricing, we dumped them and went to Walmart. Why? Because it was a consumeristic relationship, and we might have gone to school with their kids, and they helped us, but it never got to a covenant. Consumeristic commitment. And when they couldn't match the prices, they were gone. Now, again, the difference in a covenant relationship and a consumeristic relationship is the difference in a good marriage and a bad marriage. Because in a bad marriage, you might say, well, we have a commitment. I mean, we got up, we said the peace, we said, you know, for better or worse, but what we really meant was sort of worse, not worse. We said richer for poorer, but we didn't mean abject poverty. just meant a rough run. I mean, there's a part that was there saying, you know what, if I keep giving long enough and I don't get a great return on my investment, that's going to be a problem. Well, that's a consumeristic look at the situation. And, here's the thing, though. I was thinking about this, and I think I've shared this before. And let me go back to a different thought. You have to have the marriage in covenant form. Most people have to have that to stay together. If Jenny and I had a long-term cohabitation before we got married, we'd have never stayed together. It might have lasted 3 or 4 years, but I mean, it took the marriage certificate to keep us together. And that's true for most people. I mean, if you haven't, first of all, married, and again, that's the problem with, I think, trying to have that relationship without the marriage certificate. There's not enough to keep you together through the ups and downs. And most marriages can't survive without that anyway. And the reason a lot of marriages are good today is because they actually got married and they stayed in the covenantal form of the relationship. There was a study done a while back, and this is what it found. It looked at thousands of marriages, and the research came down to this point. If you say today, I have a bad marriage, if you will stay in the marriage, 5 years later, people who now say they have a bad marriage, if they will stay in the marriage, two-thirds will rate their marriage as good. Now, you might be in the one-third, which would be sad, but you got about a 70% chance of having a good marriage if you can just write out the bad part of it. So you have to have a commitment. If you're committed, now, again, if you're not married and you're living together, you really have no incentive to write out the bad part. If you're in a marriage and it's a consumeristic relationship and it's not a covenant, you're not sort of looking at each other as kids saying, I'm going to quit asking, what have you done for me lately? If you're still, you know, singing, you know, what is it, Paula Abdul? What have you done for me lately? Got that on my mind. If you're there, you're not going to have the commitment level that you need to write out the bad part. If you'll just stay in there and keep working, you're going to reach good days again, 70% of the time. But you have to have the commitment and the covenant with each other. Now, there are always going to be issues. Again, life changes. Issues come that are unexpected. People come that are unexpected. Your lifestyle changes. The money sometimes dries up. Sometimes the in-laws move in. But you have to hold and say, we are committed. We have made a vow that one of us will be saying, I'll see you in heaven to the other one. And we are not going to come into this relationship with a what have you done for me lately mentality. You're not Food City and I'm not Ingles. We are committed to each other in a covenant relationship. And so, again, I think that that's what the Bible repeatedly drives at for you and I. I could say a lot more on that, but I'm going to spare you. Why, as we're committed and we're in a covenant with each other, what is the ultimate goal of the relationship then? And you have that here in verses 13 and 14. It says that a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he's willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. By the way, this issue of the husband sanctifying the wife and the wife sanctifying the husband is also surfaced there in Ephesians 5 when it talks about Christ sanctifying the church. So, and then it brings that analogy down to a man and a woman in a relationship. Now, again, he isn't saying it's okay to marry an unbeliever, because later or in the chapter before, or in 2 Corinthians 6, he talks about not being unequally yoked with non-believers. But again, these are two people who have gotten married, and one has walked away from the Lord, or perhaps they were both unsaved when they got married, and one has now come to Christ. And he's dealing with a very logical question here that any Jew would have asked, which is, all right, I'm a believer, I'm now married to an unbeliever, should I divorce them? Now, see, in the Old Testament, if you were clean, you could become unclean. So if I'm ceremonial clean, but I touch a dead body, guess what? I become unclean. If I touch a leper, I'm clean, but ceremonially, I would become unclean. The unclean makes the clean unclean. And that could be what's going on in the parable of the Good Samaritan, where the religious people pass by because they don't want to touch this man who appears to perhaps be dead. And they're heading to the temple, and they're ceremonial clean, and they don't want to be unclean because they're going to have to be through a week of ceremony to get ceremonially clean again. Now, that was taken into marriage in the Old Testament, and you might remember when Nehemiah and then Ezra returns to Israel after Babylonian captivity, that Ezra shows up and he's trying to get the people straightened out, and he leads a great revival. But one of the things that has happened is Jews have married Gentiles. And remember, Ezra says, you all got to get a divorce. And it was a harsh command, because some of those marriages might have been 20 years. They had kids. And he said, if you're a Jew, you can't be married to a non-Jew. It makes you ceremonial unclean. That's a Jew-Gentile relationship. You can't have it. And so there was mass divorce under Ezra that was instituted under his spiritual leadership. So again, it's not a far-fetched question for Paul to have to address the issue, is that if you are a believer, should you divorce a non-believer? Are they making you unclean before God, so to speak? Are they making you unclean? Are they compromising you before the Lord? Now, the neat thing here that Paul gets at, which is a great turn, is that in the Old Testament, if I was clean, ceremonial clean, I touch a dead body, I eat unclean food, I touch somebody who's ceremonially unclean, a leper, somebody with a blood disorder, I would become unclean. But in the New Testament, Paul's getting at a bigger principle, which is it goes the other way. The clean can make the unclean clean. In the Old Testament, the unclean always made the clean unclean. But in the New Testament, greater is he that is within you than he that is in the world. And so it's interesting that woman who has the issue of blood, she's ceremonially unclean. She gets up there and she touches the hem of Jesus' garment. In the Old Testament, the unclean makes Jesus, if that was Old Testament, Jesus would now become unclean because somebody unclean touched him. But guess what happened? The clean made the unclean clean. She was healed of her disease. And so the beauty then that Paul is getting at here in a marriage is, listen, in the Old Testament, the unclean mate might have made the clean or righteous mate unclean, but in the New Testament, the clean or righteous or sanctified mate has more power than the unclean or unrighteous. And who's to say that you might not make them righteous? Who can say that you might not have the influence? Who's to say that you might not be the source of them coming to Christ? It's a beautiful principle. I wish I had the energy to really drive that home, because that's a great difference in the Old Testament and the New Testament terminology. The point then is this. The end result, both in Ephesians chapter 5 and 1 Corinthians 7, which are the two great theological statements Paul makes on marriage, is this. The end result of a marriage is mutual sanctification. That's the end result. What's the final purpose of me and my wife being together? To have children? No. That's nice. To build a house? No. To bring about the end of our mutual loneliness? That's a benefit, but no. To build a legacy together? No. To mutually love each other? No. To bring each other happiness? No. The end for Christians is to be sanctifiers of each other, to help each other become all that God wants us to be, and to help each other get to heaven. That's the end result. Now again, if you're a consumer, you can't accept that. If you come into the relationship with, you know, I'm going to do these things for you and you're going to do these things for me, and again, you know, I'm not going to come out and say it, but you're sort of like Food City to me, and if, you know, if I'm putting way more into this thing than I think I'm getting out, then that's going to bring about a little wobbliness in my level of commitment, then it's all about you, boo. And a godly marriage isn't all about you. It's just not about your happiness. It's about helping the other person get to heaven and become all that God wants them to be. It's about the husband sanctifying the wife and the wife sanctifying the husband. That's what a godly marriage is about. And that's a powerful thing. If you're married, no one can help you more in your spiritual life and no one can hurt you more in your spiritual life than your mate. That's the power of the relationship. A marriage has unique power. That's why, you know, one of the lessons many of us learned when we first got married was that we can't talk to our mate like we talk to anybody else. I mean, you're at the job and you tell somebody what you think, but you guys just work together. You come home and use the same tone with your wife and it is war. I mean, you can't talk to me like you work with me. You can't talk to me like one of the guys. And the reason is because it's a marriage where our words matter more to each other than anyone else does. And part of that is the intimacy that we have. The more intimacy you have with a person, the more they can hurt you, the more they can cut you, because they know you better. I mean, if the whole world thinks you're smart, but your wife thinks you're the dumbest person who ever lived, you're going to feel stupid. And if the whole world thinks you're misguided, but your wife keeps telling you you're the smartest person I ever knew, you're going to walk through life with a degree of confidence. I mean, we have the power to shape ourselves. I mean, when Ezra was telling everybody, if you're a Jew and you're married to a Gentile, you got to break it up. You got to get a divorce. One of the illustrations he used, I think, there in Nehemiah 13, is Solomon. He says Solomon was the wisest man in the world. You know how Solomon started out. He was a godly man, but his wives led him astray. And what Ezra is saying is, you all have not reckoned with the power that you have over each other. And that's under the old covenant. That's before we were filled with the Spirit. I mean, greater is he that's in you than he that is in the world. That's New Testament. That was an Old Testament.
You and I have tremendous ability to shape each other. And we can absolutely elevate each other, or we can absolutely destroy each other. But the most important person in your life that is going to determine more than anyone else whether you live a victorious life for Christ and whether you live holy apart from God is going to be your mate. It's going to be your mate. And Christians recognize that power. And so we become stewards of each other. Her job is to sanctify me. My job is to sanctify her as much as two people can do that for each other. 1 Peter 3:1 through 2 says, "Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear." And again, we'll get into what submission means there in a couple of weeks. But what he's saying is a wife has so much power over her husband that she doesn't even have to say it. It's possible that just her example can win her husband to the Lord. The possibility exists because of the power that a wife has over her husband and the power that a husband has over his wife. Now, I know that she's a pill. I know that he's not kind all the time. But I would also remind you of one more thing. You say, how can we do this? And the answer is because we have a reservoir of love given to us by Christ. Again, we've talked about this in times past, but here's the theory. Christians are supposed to be love philanthropists. What that means is this. If you're a philanthropist, that means you're so rich you can just give money away and not expect anybody to give it back. You've got billions. You can give $1 million away and you don't need it back. Now, if you're poor, I can't give you a lot. If I give it to you, you got to give it back to me. I can make you a loan, but if I keep giving to you, I don't have a lot. If you don't give back to me, I got to cut you off. Now, Christians have been baptized with the love of God. We're rich in love. God has loved us so much. Christ has demonstrated his love so much on Calvary for us that we ought to be so rich in love that we can love without getting it in return. We're like we're Elon Musk when it comes to love. I can just give it to you and give it to you and give, because I have so much love coming from God. I have so much love being poured in me from Jesus Christ. I can give it to you. I don't need you to love me. I can give you love because I'm being loved by God. I have this heavenly bank account of love and I'm a gazillionaire. Now that's the theory. Now, if I don't have that, if I haven't experienced the love of God, if I don't have that operating in my life, then I'm sort of poor in love, and what I give to you, I got to get back from you at some point because I'm in poverty. It makes all the difference in the world then if you're a Christian and you recognize the riches that God has poured into you. I'm able to love you without getting love in return. At least for an extended period of time, because I'm rich in love. And I don't need your love. I dwell in the love of Christ. Again, if I don't have that, I can love you, but I'm poor. You got to give it back to me. If I'm not getting enough back from you, then I got to cut you off. Christians are rich in love. And when you look at how then Christ loved us, he didn't love us because we were lovely. He loved us to make us lovely. He didn't give his life for us because we were great catches. He gave his life to make us great catches. There ought to be a part of us. And now, I realize a marriage is tricky and there's great power. And when people, when you're in a tough marriage, I mean, the words sting. I mean, they can hurt because we have the power to shape and crush each other. But if both people have massive reservoirs of love flowing into them from God, it ought to make a difference in how long we can hang in there and how much love we can give, even when we don't sense that it's coming back to us. It can make a big difference. I've told you this multiple times, but my mom and dad got married when they were 17 and 16, and dad was a crazy guy from a crazy house, and they ended up having three kids by the time they were 23. And dad was raised to be a hard drinker and liked to fight and could not find the self-will to be faithful to my mother in those first 6 years. And my grandma didn't want mom moving back with three kids. So she would keep telling my mom, "Hang in there, someday he'll make you a good husband." Well, you know, they would joke later that dad couldn't afford the child support and mom couldn't afford to live by herself, so they hung in there. And they both got saved, though. It made the difference. Made the difference. And I've told the illustration here, but it was my mom, you know. I talked to my mom once and I said, you know, and I wasn't being critical of my dad. I said, "But mom, you know, although you still remember all the women he cheated on you with, don't you?" She said, "Yeah, but it's like reading Gone with the Wind. We were two different people. It's like there's no emotional connection to that. It's like reading about Rhett and Scarlett. There was Ron and Kathy before Christ, and there's Ron and Kathy after Christ, and those are two different people." They went on and had 60 years of marriage and had a large family, and they experienced great contentment, and it was the great joy of their life to be together, and they were there at the end. Dad had his faculties till the end, and there, when he felt life leaving him, he gasped, and but then his strength came back, and he looked up at her there, and he said, I forget the timing. I might be flipping this, but he said, "Just hold me." And she cradled him in her arms, and he looked at her and said, "You are precious to me." She said, "You are precious to me," and he died. And they had it. She said, "Goodbye, I'll see you later." He went on to heaven. If they'd been a modern marriage, I don't know if they would have survived those first 6 years. But they found Christ. It made all the difference in the world for me. Make all the difference in the world for you too. God bless you. Will you stand? Our Father in heaven, we thank you.